Hello and welcome to History by Hollywood, a podcast series that examines the real events and people behind facts-based movies. Welcome to episode 19 for Sunday, 22nd of October, 2017. And today we're looking at 1989's Glory, starring Denzel Washington, Morgan Freeman and Matthew Broderick. My name is Andrew Blischick, and with me as ever is Martin Darlington.
Hello everybody. Just before we get into the show, we've got some errata and updates. Our good friend and our theme music composer, Jules Cisek, noticed that for some reason in the last episode, Apollo 13, we mentioned Apollo 8 as the disaster that had caused the deaths of three astronauts when it was, of course, Apollo 1. This was also noticed by self-confessed space geek Brian Willett, who also pointed out that Apollo 1 didn't explode, but a fire caused by another electrical short circuit swept through the capsule during a drill, and because they used pure oxygen, the fire was very intense and it proved fatal to the three astronauts aboard.
Brian also had a wonderful piece of extra information. Apparently Apollo 13's service and command modules were made by North America Manufacturing. They were both powered back to Earth by the lunar module, which was made by Grumman, who North American considered to be their junior partner in the project. The lunar module was only designed to fly a relatively short distance from the orbiting command module to the moon and then back again. Within hours, though, of the much longer journey and the safe recovery of the astronauts, Grumman sent North American representatives in the control center an invoice for, quote, towing services, which they calculated as $312,421.24. Brian also recommends Gene Kranz's book, Failure is Not an Option, as a cracking good read for anyone wanting to know more about this era at NASA.
We've also had some listener feedback. Grant Kennedy Musgrove wrote to us on the Facebook page and he said, loving the podcast, which was very nice of him. And he also made some suggestions on movies we might like to cover in the future, one of which was Glory, which we're doing today. Mm-hmm. Another was Seabiscuit, which we're happy to announce we're doing in two weeks' time. And his third suggestion was Tombstone, which we've got kind of slated for the very near future. Yeah. So in answer to Grant's suggestions, yes, right now, yes, next on Sunday the 5th of November, and Tombstone is on the shortlist.
Other suggestions that Grant made were of sports movies, and that got us thinking about which to do. We haven't covered a sports film since Rush, way back in episode 2. And after Seabiscuit, which is up next, we could do some more on the list if anyone has any suggestions. We'd love to hear them. Grant thought of Miracle, about the 1980s US versus Soviet Union ice hockey semi-finals in the Olympics, and a bunch of baseball films, none of which either of us have seen, although Moneyball we have considered.
Okay, so on to today's show. Of the movie.
Yeah. So, as we mentioned, we're doing Glory today. It's a 1989 movie set in the US Civil War and depicts the events around the creation and deployment of the first all-black regiment?
It was the fourth, but the other three had all been recruited from what were referred to as contrabands, which were freed or runaway slaves.
So this is first?
The first of three blacks from the north.
Namely the 54th Regiment, the Massachusetts Volunteer Infantry. Glory was directed by Robert Zwick, who in 1989 was at the start of his career. He went on to direct and produce some famous movies, including the Oscar-winning Shakespeare in Love, which gave Zwick a Best Picture Oscar as its producer. And I think Harvey Weinstein was somehow involved in Shakespeare in Love too, controversially.
That's a bit topical. The screenplay was written by Kevin Jarre, who based the script on the original letters of the main character, Colonel Robert Gould Shaw, portrayed in the movie by Matthew Broderick. Other stars in Glory included Morgan Freeman as Sergeant Major Rawlins and Denzel Washington as Private Silas Tripp.
It was a critical success, currently holding a 93% positive rating on Rotten Tomatoes. And it was nominated for a slew of awards. And for his role as Private Tripp, Denzel Washington won both the Golden Globe and the Oscar for Best Supporting Actor in 1990. It won two other Oscars, Best Cinematography and Best Sound Editing.
It was a modest financial success as well. It cost about $18 million to make, and it took around $27 million at the box office, which if you think in terms of investments, that's not bad. It's a 33% or 50% profit on the original outlay.
Yeah, but given how positive reviews were and at the time, it maybe could have made a bit more money.
You'd have thought so.
Yeah. It runs for just on 2 hours and was filmed on location in Massachusetts and Georgia. It was made, as we said, in 1989 and released in early 1990. So it actually predates Ken Burns' famous documentary series on the Civil War by a few months, which resulted in an incredible newfound interest in the US Civil War, the bloodiest of all American wars.
So the sources we've used are extracts of the letters of Robert Gould Shaw, which is obviously a very subjective account. Also, I've read A Brave Black Regiment, which is a history of the 54th Regiment of Massachusetts Infantry by Captain Louis F. Emilio. And he was an officer serving with the unit through this period. So again, subjective. Quite subjective.
Also, Martin, I think, has used Fighting for Glory, the 54th Massachusetts Volunteer Infantry, by Charles Rivers Editors.
Yeah, they're a kind of conglomerate group. It's almost a bit Reader's Digest. But they do list their sources. There was a really good article that Andrew found by Donald Iacovone called The 54th Massachusetts Infantry, The Pay Crisis and the Lincoln Despotism.
And there's lots of other articles, including one by James McPherson in TNR Classics, 1990 Glory, Can Movies Teach History? And as I say, lots of other articles and links. There's a lot out there on the web about this one.
Yeah. Okay, so on with the film itself. And the opening screen is a scrolling text that informs us that Robert Gould Shaw, the son of wealthy Boston abolitionists, was 23 when he signed up to fight in the US Civil War on the Union side. Now, he regularly wrote letters home describing life in the Army of the Potomac, and those letters are now preserved in the Houghton Library of Harvard University.
Okay, so we've had our first claim of facts, the fact that Robert Shaw was a person in the Army and was 23. So let's set the scene first. By this time, the Civil War between the slave-owning Southern states and the abolitionist states of the North had started already with the South's attack on Fort Sumter in South Carolina, 1861. So by the time of Glory, 2 years later, 1863, the war had been going for 2 years, and the main character, Robert Shaw, was now 25 years old. He'd volunteered at the start of the war and had already seen action at the battles of Cedar Mountain and Antietam.
Shaw was from a prominent Boston abolitionist family, but apparently he was originally not quite as committed to the cause as his father was. Until the war, he'd been a little bit of aimless youth.
Yep.
He'd spent some time travelling and studying in Europe, and then attended Harvard from 56 to 59, but dropped out without finishing his degree. And the premise of the film, that there were free black men in the North seeking to fight to help free their Southern brothers, is quite correct.
So then the first opening scene...
back to the movie.
Back to the movie. We shift to a Union Army camp at sunrise. Mail's being handed out. Some soldiers play while others drills. We meet Captain Robert Shaw, played by Matthew Broderick, as we hear his voice reading a letter to his mother. As Shaw's soldiers march in the other direction, we see black refugees walking towards safety.
Yeah, and I think we just need to do a very quick reality note that it is worth noting that apart from Robert Shaw, every character in the movie depicted as having served in the 54th Massachusetts is actually fictional. We're not quite sure what the reason for this was. Most other characters, particularly the prominent military and political ones, are based on real people, but everyone serving in the 54th, apart from the CO, are fictional.
Okay.
Which is, yeah, strange.
So that means that other than Frederick Douglass, who we'll get to later, all the other black characters are fictional.
I guess it's true, yeah. As far as the black characters go. So, back to the movie.
We see the Union troops march out onto a field, and we see their Confederate enemies also arriving. The captions inform us that this is the Battle of Antietam Creek in Maryland, September 17, 1862.
Yeah, and a quite vicious battle starts. And I was just reading earlier, actually, that the, a lot of the battles were done by reenactment groups who voluntarily did it, didn't get paid for it. But there's heavy casualties. We see Robert Shaw wounded and he's lying on the field. And as he regains consciousness, possibly the next morning, that we see some African-American men are walking the field looking for soldiers still alive. And Captain Shaw regains consciousness to be looked down on a black by a black man who asks if he's all right. And this is Morgan Freeman.
Yeah, and okay, so did that really happen? The opening scenes and injury Robert Shaw. Well, I think they got that right, didn't they? That's correct, isn't it? He was wounded. They show him particularly with an ear wound. I don't know where exactly the wound was, but he was wounded.
Yeah, his neck and ear, I think.
And was retired back home to Boston, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. Well, he was on, I think he was on medical leave, and he went back for recuperation. But whilst he's being treated in the movie, a medical orderly tells him, "Oh, we've just heard some news. The President Lincoln's going to issue the Emancipation Proclamation," which he hadn't done up till then. And this is something I've only really realised. So sorry, I'm just throwing a bit of reality back in here again.
Good.
That actually the Civil War didn't start because even though Lincoln was an abolitionist, he realised he'd lose some the border states between the Mason-Dixon line, the ones sat on there, Kentucky and Tennessee.
Yeah.
Kentucky and Missouri amongst them. And he'd said, we really need to keep Kentucky on our side. What the original argument was, the expansion westward, he'd said the new western states will not have slavery.
Yeah.
And the Confederate South said, it will, because that's how we make the most profit. So it wasn't initially a war over abolition, it was a war over limiting the spread
of slavery.
Slave states. Yeah.
Okay. So where are we as far as the movie is concerned?
Well, we now cut back to Massachusetts and we see a recovered or recovering Shaw amongst his family and friends at a genteel party. He meets a black man called Thomas, an obvious friend. This is Thomas Searle. And Thomas Searle Shaw, he's now working for his father. He's obviously an educated man. And Shaw's father introduced him to both Governor Andrew, who's the governor of Massachusetts, and another prominent abolitionist, and a distinguished-looking elderly black man called Frederick Douglass. Shaw is told that Governor Andrew plans to raise a regiment of black soldiers, and he invites Shaw to be put forward as the colonel, which would be quite a jump, captain to colonel in one leap. His reaction is stunned silence, then a sort of stumbling acceptance. And he walks away looking a bit dazed as everyone congratulates him because they obviously knew.
Okay, so that's a key scene where he gets his commission. How did they go with that one? I think I understand that the offer to Robert Shaw was brought to him in writing by his father. His father, as we've said, was a very prominent abolitionist. Governor Andrews had in fact identified the need for experienced, capable officers, including Shaw, who were committed abolitionists. But
There was a lot of resistance to the raising of black regiments, even in the North. They might have wanted to abolish slavery, but there was this attitude of, oh, they won't
they're
be able
not
to
capable.
Fight. No, they're not capable. Governor Andrew clearly believed, yes, they are, but we've got to create the conditions in which they can succeed. So part of the, even though there were people like Thomas Searle, albeit he's a fictional character, but there were educated,
free black men
living in the North,
ready to fight,
who could have been very capable officers, but as to assuage the concerns, Governor Andrew said, right, the officers will be white, but he needed officers who wanted it to succeed, not who, might...
Reluctant participants or something like that.
And they needed to be good, so he wanted veterans.
So what about Shaw's intentions and enthusiasm for the project?
Supposedly he refused. He said to his father, no, that's just going to be too... But I just want to be a soldier, I just want to serve the Union and win this Civil War. But that's so politically fraught, he refused, slept on it, and before his father returned to Boston next morning, said, no, actually, I've changed my mind, I'll do it.
So, they did okay with the history on that one. I mean, he looked a bit stunned and surprised, and in reality, it took him 24 hours to say yes. But for Hollywood's sake, he said yes pretty much in the movie straight away.
And he says it to another character we meet, going back to the movie, Cabot Forbes, played by Cary Elwes, who's obviously quite drunk, and he's sort of laughing at Robert Shaw for the idea of commanding coloured troops. And then Shaw stares at him and says, "I'm going to do it, and I want you to join me." And Forbes just laughs again and says, "Yeah, okay." Ridiculous. And then their friend Thomas Searles, played by Andre Brewer, he comes out and says, "I'd like to be your first volunteer."
Okay, so we've already said that that there's a lot of fictional characters in here, and both the Forbes character, who goes on to play an important role in the rest of the film, and Searle, Thomas Searle, his friend, are both fictional, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so now back to the movie. We see a crowd of black men dressed in civilian clothing calling out, you know, good-naturedly to the now Colonel Shaw as he rides amongst them. "When are we going to get a blue suit?" they say. "When are we going to get to fight?" So the response to the announcement of this regiment, 54th Massachusetts, has clearly been huge. Shaw then recognises John Rawlins, the Morgan Freeman character we saw on the field in Antietam when he regained consciousness after the battle. Shaw then makes a speech to a rousing cheer before they are all formed into companies. Next, we see the volunteers, many barefoot, marching to their camp, which the caption announces as Redville Camp, Massachusetts. And we learn the date is November 1862.
Yeah, we watch Union troops in camp calling out in pretty harsh derision as the black volunteers march past. Rawlins and Searle settle into a tent, and we meet another character, Private Silas Tripp, played by Denzel Washington, and he ribs Searle for being an educated man before telling him to get out of his space. He's like, "No, I'm having the space by the door." So Thomas Searle says, "I need to be by the door so I can read in the light from the campfires."
Yeah.
And he said, "No, I don't care what you want, get out of my bed space." So Tripp is immediately identified as quite
a troublemaker,
aggressive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so how did they do with this representation of the zeitgeist of the black people up north?
Yeah, I mean, the response was huge. It's obvious that people didn't come from just Massachusetts. It came from all over the north, particularly in the northeast county, northeast states. Because a lot of them have been waiting for this opportunity. You know, let us fight for our freedom as well. You know, we don't want to be given it by you guys. Let us contribute. The reaction of the white troops was fairly well depicted. Derision, contempt, disbelief, didn't think there'd be any fighting spirit or capability. Probably an element of feeling a bit threatened as well by, you know, this is an unknown quantity. What if it turns out to be better than us?
Okay. So back to the movie?
Yeah. We see a scene in the mess hall, which is fictional, because the characters involved are fictional except for Colonel Shaw, but it's quite revealing of the job he'd have had to get everyone formalised and, you know, used to being soldiers in a very short space of time, because Cabot Forbes, the major, is reprimanded by Colonel Shaw for fraternising with Thomas Searle. He says, you know, we need a proper instructor to turn these men into soldiers. You're an officer, he's a private. You know, you can't just be chatting away to him using first names.
So Thomas Searle, being the black guy we saw in Massachusetts, was a friend of
an intellectual equal of them, he'd grown up with them, you know.
Yeah.
And he's even though he's fictional, he is quite a good illustrative character, as we see his character change and turn into a soldier's, and accepting eventually the fact of the officers and the soldiers are separated.
I mean, Searle seems to be like a younger Frederick Douglass, you know, an educated black man that can hold his own with white peers.
And of course, when we see Frederick Douglass in the film, he's depicted as a grey-bearded elderly guy. He was actually a very vigorous 45-year-old, and in reality, two of his sons served in the 54th. One of whom was the regimental sergeant major, and I think, why didn't they use that?
I think there are famous images of Frederick Douglass where he is white-haired and older, and they just kind of played on that, I guess.
So going back to the movie, and after Colonel Shaw says we need a proper teacher, we next see the volunteers still in civilian clothing being drilled under the tutelage of Sergeant Major Mulcahy, played by a character called John Finn. He's an Irish veteran soldier, and he is just, as a former soldier myself, he is the epitome of a gruff sergeant major. And what he does is very clever. He basically abuses all the men, bullies them, shouts at them. And his His racist insults to them are quite funny. He calls them Negroes, Coloureds, Hindus, Mexicans.
Everything except Negroes.
Everything except, yeah. In fact, yeah, sorry, he doesn't call them Negro. He calls them, you Mexican scum, you damned Hindus.
And I think he's like the black soul. He's a fictional character, isn't he?
He is, well, but you can imagine that for them to have turned into the very effective unit they did in such a short space of time, they probably had someone like him.
Yeah.
And he did that classic thing. He provided the troops with a common enemy himself.
Yeah.
And that creates a bond between them, which makes them become a unit. And the more intelligent ones quickly realise he's actually doing this for our benefit, not because he's a psychopath.
Yeah.
And it's at this stage that we see the troops assembled, and on a rainy night, reads out a dispatch that the Confederacy have just announced any black soldiers captured will be put to death or returned to slavery, or put to slavery, as will any white officer leading the black troops. He tells them that anyone who wants to leave will be given a full discharge in the morning. And we see the men going back to their tents, contemplating their options. And of course, in the morning, all the men are still present.
So that's some good news for him. And we see more drill, more training. We see Sergeant Major Mulcahy again berating the recruits. And then we see finally John Rawlins issuing much-awaited rifles to the men. We see Thomas Searle addressing his friend Colonel Shaw as Robert, and asks if it's true that they'll be allowed to fight, as all they'd heard that they'd be used as for manpower, not soldier power. Shaw almost ignores him as he watches the men playing mock fights in anticipation of the battle.
Yeah. We then, and I think actually we should just wrap that up, the Confederacy did indeed say that any black soldiers captured in uniform will be enslaved or executed, and any white officers leading them will be executed.
Yeah.
In response, the Lincoln administration said, you put one of our soldiers, irrespective of their colour or creed, into slavery, one of yours will be put to hard labour. You execute one of ours, we'll execute one of yours. So it actually didn't happen officially. There were a couple of cases we'll deal with the summary.
But
they missed a trick.
Yeah.
They missed a trick, the Confederates. Stupid. Not surprisingly,
yeah.
But they, sorry, I'm letting my political views slip in there,
oh, yeah.
But they, it was counterproductive because it made the black guys feel, okay, the officers are in it with us.
Yeah.
If they'd said, oh, any white officers captured, now of course they'll be treated as gentlemen and prisoners of war, whereas any black soldier, it could have caused a rift. It's easy for you to lead us in a battle, you get captured and you're all right.
But they were all in it together.
No, they were all in it together.
And the movie portrays that, I imagine. It would have had a galvanising effect in reality, which is what they get across, because nobody takes up the opportunity for a discharge. They're all in it, as it were.
Yeah. Back to the movie, we then see them on the rifle range, and Private Sharps, who's another new character we've met, and he's a very quiet, innocent, sort of almost childlike young fella, but he proves to be an absolutely excellent shot. Shaw congratulates him, but then says, accuracy is great, but you've got to be able to fire 3 rounds a minute. And he says, reload, reload. And Sharps is struggling to reload. Shaw stands behind him, firing his revolver in the air. And it's like a lesson in the realities of battlefield, of battlefields. And at the same time, we see tension growing between Major Forbes and Colonel Shaw. And he's saying, why are you being so hard on the men? Why are you being so hard on our friend Thomas? And Shaw's answer is, Thomas isn't a very good soldier, and I'm trying to prepare them for battle.
So it's clear that at least among the officers, who are all white, that there's no real expectation of actual fighting, but the troops are still being driven by Mulcahy. Next, we see them doing bayonet practice. Thomas Searle, the bookish one of the troop, has been christened Bonnie Prince Charles by Sergeant Major Mulcahy. Mulcahy mocks him for his half-hearted bayonetting and orders Searle to stab him. Searle tries reluctantly, Mulcahy knocking his rifle away with contempt, until Searle finally has a proper go. He's disarmed and knocked to the ground immediately by Mulcahy. Searle breaks into tears and approaches Colonel Shaw and again addresses him as Robert. Shaw tells him that an enlisted man wishing to speak to his commanding officer needs to go through the chain of command and seek permission.
Yeah, then we get another letter voiceover from Shaw, which is a kind of, you know, a good linking narration technique. And it's him writing to his mother, and there's snow falling, and he says they've heard of another Union defeat, and he also starts to doubt his own ability and courage. But he walks amongst the tent and he bumps into Thomas Sir and he says, "Merry Christmas, Robert." And Shaw replies, with no one listening, "Merry Christmas, Thomas." Nice. So it's a nice little, you know, he is still human. He's just trying to do a job. And
so a lot of this is, well, all of this is fictional because none of the black characters are right. So there's not a lot of history to comment on at this stage, is there, for reality check?
Except the fact that the Union were struggling. They were losing.
Yeah.
Most of the battles they'd engaged in, they'd lost to the Confederacy. And Lincoln knew there were thousands of untapped volunteers amongst the black population, but he had to keep the slave-owning states that hadn't lined up with the Confederacy, like Kentucky and Missouri, out of the fight on the other side at least. And he said it apparently once, "On our side, I hope we have God, but I must have Kentucky." They did eventually. They were never formally incorporated into the Confederacy, but I think both of them did lean slightly more towards that direction, even though Kentucky troops did fight on the Union side.
I think Kentucky's... Lincoln's associated with Illinois, but I think he was born in Kentucky too, so he has,
right.
I think he
was. Yeah, connections there.
Back to the movie?
Yeah.
We see the officer's mess, Shaw talking to the quartermaster, who is, you know, clearly racist about the capability of black troops. The quartermaster tells Shaw that if he needs anything, he should drop by.
There's a sort of implication of nice bottle of brandy.
Yeah. And the quartermaster is, you know, controls the stores. He's the guy to go to. If you go in with the quartermaster, you can get pretty much whatever you need.
Yeah.
Shaw replies that the only thing he needs is shoes for his men. And the quartermaster says that they're reserved for troops who need to get ready for fighting, implying that, you know, the blacks are never going to fight.
Yeah, and then the next scene is Major Forbes reporting to Colonel Shaw that they've caught a deserter, and it's the Denzel Washington character, Private Tripp. He's marched past the assembled troops. Sergeant Major Mulcahy prepares to flog Tripp as Major Forbes argues with Colonel Shaw, and Shaw orders Major Forbes to stand at attention, berates him for questioning his orders. Tripp is flogged without a sound, and it's an incredibly powerful scene. He's just staring.
Well, even before they flog him, they rip the shirt off his back, and his back is scarred from previous beatings, previous whippings, floggings. Yeah. So, you know, there's a moment of sympathy in Shaw's eyes, but he's got to be a tough, you know, tough leader to his men, and so he says, proceed to flog him.
But Tripp just stares at Shaw with an absolute... I mean, it's Denzel Washington. He didn't win an Oscar for no good reason.
Yeah.
But he's staring and then just a single tear's trickling down his cheek as he's getting flogged, but he doesn't make a sound. And later that night, John Shaw visits John Rawlings, the Morgan Freeman character. Says he'd like to be able to speak with him at times about the men, if he'd be agreeable. And Rawlings says that the men need shoes. And Shaw says, "No, I'm trying to get those." And Rawlings says, "No, now." Tripp wasn't deserting. He was trying to find shoes. And he shows him his feet. Tripp's laid out, being treated for his flog
back injuries.
And he sees his feet and they're absolutely devastated. And to wrap all that bits up about the supply system or the supply situation, absolutely true. They really struggled, and nearly all white officers outside the unit thought, oh, they're symbolic, they're going to be used for labour or a service battalion, they're not actually going to fight. And Shaw's struggles to get them fully equipped is testified to by several eyewitnesses. Although his letters don't really say, I met this corrupt quartermaster who I had to threaten with violence before he gave me what I needed. But Lewis Emilio's book says Shaw was amazing. He said whether it was he knew he had political backing and he was not untouchable, but, you know, he's still within chain of command, but he was quite willing to threaten, cajole, blackmail, and to get what he felt his men were needed. And his point was, you know, I'm preparing them to fight, but they definitely won't let us fight if we don't have the equipment.
Which very quickly brings us to the next scene, which you've already hinted at, that we see Shaw visiting the quartermaster, accompanied by some of his black troops. He calls, amongst other things, the quartermaster a son of a bitch and starts trashing the stores and suggests... Did he suggest some corruption
to the
quartermaster at this stage?
Let me get your account books out and let's see what you say got and what you've actually got and all this sort of thing.
And next thing you know, Shaw emerges from the quartermaster's office with a big grin to John Rawlings, the Morgan Freeman character, and the next scene we see shoes being handed out to some happy men back at the camp. So, you know, as you've already mentioned, they've compressed his need to do whatever it takes to get his men what they want, into a neat little scene, which is nice.
And they do the same on the next scene, which is Shaw addressing the men, informing them that although they were enlisted on the standard union wage for soldiers of $13 a month with no deductions, he's just learned that as a coloured regiment, they're only going to be paid $10 a month, plus they're going to have $3 a month subtracted for uniforms and food and lodging, so they're actually only going to get $7. As the men queue for their pay, Tripp starts going amongst them. Denzel Washington character saying, no, boycott the lesser pay. And he tears up his pay slip. Other men start to join in. Shaw's stood up on his sort of dais watching this. And he fires his revolver in the air to get their attention, I think. They all stare at him and he said, if you will accept no pay, none of us will. And he tears his pay slip in half. And the men cheer him, uniforms arrive, and in the next scene we see them marching through the streets of Boston as the Governor Andrew and Frederick Douglass and other dignitaries cheer.
Okay, so let's pause it there for a minute because there's some interesting facts going on here. As we've already mentioned, one of the sources that we've looked at is David Iacovone's The 54th Massachusetts Infantry, The Pay Crisis and Lincoln Despotism. So we've already hinted that there might be something about this pay crisis in history. So it's enough to know that the movie pays a little bit of attention to it, but this dispute actually is true. I mean, they were paid $10 versus $13. They were expecting to get a regular wage. And the commanders, the officers, they also declined to get paid, which in the movie is quite true and sounds very sympathetic and encouraging and heroic. However, they almost kind of gloss over it. There's one scene where it's mentioned, but in reality, it was a bitter, long-going dispute between the troops that were fighting for the North and the Northern administrators. It went on for 18 months.
Yeah, and they had people like Frederick Douglass were mobilised at home to raise money for the guys who had families because they weren't receiving any pay, so subsistence.
Time.
But they said, until you pay us equally, which is how you promised us on recruitment, we're not taking any pay from the government. And Colonel Shaw and the other officers also drew no pay. And Shaw wrote letters to Governor Andrew, his own father, military commanders, politicians, and even President Lincoln's office saying, you know, you expect loyalty from these men, you give them none back. And eventually it was resolved by that time. I'm not sure I'd imagine they'd have got their back pay as well. That would have been a nice bonus. But yeah, and it was a huge thing. And in the account, there is a mention of there was a black private. And it's almost the film's version of this is the flogging of Private Tripp. Uh-huh. But in reality, a black private who was a bit like Tripp, a bit militant, but also very capable soldier, refused an order from a white officer. He said, no, we're not being paid. No, why should I do this? I think he was given latrine duty or something, which they'd just taken turns to do. And I think he struck the officer and he was executed on Colonel Shaw's orders. So you can imagine, that's a real difficult situation to try and handle. You strike an officer in wartime, you should, execution is generally the...
Especially back then?
Yeah.
So, as you say, that they compress that into the Tripp moment where he's being flogged as Shaw needed to do the tough thing.
And the parade through Boston is spot on. Mm. Absolutely right. Excellent. They were cheering crowds and they apparently looked smart as carrots and they marched very smartly and then they boarded a boat and headed south.
Which we see in the movie. They're heading down to fight, closer to the action at least. And we see Tripp say he's forgotten how hot it can get down south.
Yeah.
Shaw meets a reporter on board just as Major Forbes awards John Rawlings the rank of Sergeant Major to the cheers of the men. So this is the Morgan Freeman character who gets a non-commissioned officer role.
That's a lovely scene, though, I think.
Yeah.
Shaw shakes his hand and Rawlings quietly says to him, I ain't sure I want this, sir. And Shaw looks at him and says, I know exactly how you feel.
Very nice.
It's just really nice little comeback of, yep, I've been in that situation myself.
I'm in it right now.
But I'm here, and so are you.
Then we see Sergeant Major Rawlings marching with his men, and they see some local black children, so Morgan Freeman's character. And he tells them that what they're seeing is real and it ain't no dream. The caption informs us that they have just arrived at Beaufort, South Carolina, and it's June 1963.
1863,
thank you. The marching men are met by two contrabands, a name given to runaways or free slaves, who laugh at the uniformed men for marching and talking like white soldiers. Rawlings has to translate the southern accents for the educated Thomas Searle.
Yeah, and then we see, oh, incidentally, the reporter Shaw meets is a real character called Edward Pierce, who was a friend of his family, and he was the New York Tribune, I think, and he appears again in the movie, and I suspect he might be a conglomerate. Edward Pierce may not have been in all the places that he's shown in the film, but he's quite a useful character for them to use for the narrative.
There's a couple of times now in our movies we've seen reporters just appear as an interesting narrative device to kind of convey what's going on, probably to the audience more than anything else. Selma had one
that
on the phone explaining what's going on in case the audience didn't get it. This is another example of it. And was there one in Good Morning Vietnam, I think? I can't remember anyway.
Well, they used the radio voice a lot, didn't they?
Yeah, that's right, that's right.
So here we see, so they've arrived in the South, and we see Shaw meets a Colonel Montgomery, who tells him that Shaws are not the only black troops in the area. He commands a unit, and he's leading a foraging expedition in the morning, could do some help. And Shaw says, okay, I'll come along and we'll take A Company with us. Now, the column enters the town of Darien, Georgia. And Sergeant Major Rawlings reports to Colonel Shaw, says, no, there's no enemy troops present, just some women, a couple of old men. And Shaw's horrified when Montgomery orders his troops to loot the town. And then Montgomery turns to Shaw and says, no one would send black troops into proper combat, and derides his own men as like children. And he orders Shaw to burn the town. Shaw refuses, but Montgomery says, I'm the commanding, the unit commander here, and I'll court-martial you if you don't. So he very reluctantly orders his men to carry out the order. And that's absolutely true.
How so? I mean, the fact that... was Colonel Montgomery a real character?
He is. Now, he's painted in the movie as a racist and a brigand. In reality, we don't really know his views on his own soldiers, which the film shows as sort of paternal contempt. But he did command one of the first black units raised from runaway slaves in the South Carolina Sea Islands area.
And there really was a Darien, Georgia that was attacked?
And it was raided, and Shaw was horrified at the order to burn the town. And then when he got back to camp, wrote to General Hunter, who was the brigade commander, and said, can you confirm this was done in his orders? Now, he doesn't actually quote Hunter's precise reply, but he does say the general confirmed that he had ordered the action to be taken, to let the Southerners know that they're in a war. You know, if their men want to go off and fight against the Union, they might, and abandon them, they might face the consequences. So, pretty harsh, and it shows Shaw is quite an honourable man.
Mm, nice. Okay, so back to the movie, we see Shaw running to his father asking for some help. His men are only being used for labour, and their morale is suffering. He asks his father to write to President Lincoln and appeal on their behalf. As we see Private Tripp, baiting passing white soldiers who respond in kind. So there is some tension, obviously, between even white soldiers of the North who don't expect much of the black soldiers of the North. A fight between the two groups is averted by Rawlings, who is later called a white man's puppy by Private Tripp, who then receives a proper dressing down by Lord Rawlings about being men.
Yeah, meanwhile, Shaw and his friend Major Forbes are visiting the commanding general, and he's basically demanding a transfer to combat command. The general refuses at first, until Shaw and Forbes tell him that they're very aware of his smuggling and embezzlement operation, at which point the general, accompanied by Colonel Montgomery, agrees. In the next scene, we see the men are on their way into action.
So another fictional example of Shaw's reputation of pushing and doing whatever he needs to look after his men and get to see some action.
Yeah, I can't find any record of him using finding out something about smuggling and embezzling and using that as blackmail, but he certainly was very persistent in... Well, they had been under the command of General Strong, who he seems to have thought very highly of. General Strong had then transferred further east or further somewhere else to take up a command of a division, and Shaw was left behind with this General Hunter, I think, and he didn't want to stay there because his men were being used to build roads and
bridges and things.
Yeah. So he asked them both, and eventually it was granted.
Okay, so back to the movie.
Yep.
The caption at the bottom of the screen informs us that the men who are now running towards battle is in fact James Island, South Carolina, and the date is the 16th of July, 1863. The men form into a firing line as some Confederate cavalry arrives. The cavalry are whooping as they charge through the woods. The rifle volleys tear through the horsemen, who quickly turn tail and ride away. The 54th then immediately face an advancing Confederate infantry. The two forces fire away at each other, causing casualties on both sides. The Confederates advance. They receive sustained fire from Shaw's men, and then they charge towards them. Shaw's men decide to react, and they start charging forward as well. Tripp and Rawlings are seen to be effective fighters. Thomas Searle is wounded, and Private Schatz picks off several enemy with his marksmanship. More Union troops arrive as the fight turns and goes the Union's way. Private Tripp is saved by a recovered Searle who bayonets an enemy soldier about to kill Tripp. So we see the rebels retreat, much to the delight of the men.
Yeah, and seeing the wounded Tom Searle, Shaw is quite moved and spends a moment with him saying, "You'll be back in Boston soon," and Tom Searle begs him not to be sent back. Get me treated here and let me stay with the unit.
So
to wrap that up in reality.
So they've had their first real encounter of the war. They're on the offensive, they're fighting, they're shooting, they're killing Confederates. How did the movie get? How did the movie go as far as James Island is concerned?
Well, there was an action on James Island, and the division here was being commanded by General Alfred H. Terry, who, for anyone who's read about the Plains Wars wars later on against the Sioux, he was the guy who was in charge of one half of the pincer intended to take down Crazy Horse's village. And he sent General Custer off on a recce with orders not to engage, and Custer obviously got wiped out. Well, half his command got wiped out, him along with it. So, that was 13 years in the future. But the 54th were posted as pickets, as a sort of an outlying line of defence and warning on the right flank of the expected line of Confederate advance. They did meet action against a much stronger Confederate force, but put up such a spirited defence as they slowly retreated that Terry's other units were able to get out without being cut off.
So they did a heroic thing, yeah?
They did. They did incredibly well. And the 10th Connecticut in particular showed great appreciation, and the letters that have been recorded of soldiers from 10th Connecticut going, "Wow, these black guys in the 54th just saved our bacon,"
That's
know.
Great.
And General Terry, the expected main Confederate attack didn't actually happen. But Captain Emilio, in his account, describes a message brought to Colonel Shaw by Shaw's adjutant, who'd just been to the General's position for orders. And General Terry said, "Tell your Colonel I am exceedingly pleased with the conduct of your regiment. They've done all they could." And in his official report, Terry singled them out for steadiness and soldierly conduct. 14 men were killed, 18 wounded, and 13 missing in action afterwards. So,
how big would the 54th have been, do you think?
About 600.
600.
Yeah.
So they lost 50 men or
something? In the British Army, they'd be called a battalion. They might also be a regiment, but quite often a regiment would have more than one battalion.
Right.
So they're a battalion strength, yeah.
So if anything, they kind of underplayed the effectiveness of the first military battle of the 54th. I mean, they show them, defeating the Confederates and putting them on the run.
But it's sort of like a skirmish.
Yeah.
In fact, it was General Beauregard, who was quite an effective, I believe, Confederate commander. They were expecting him to push through in full strength and because they didn't advance as quickly as they wanted, or as they thought they would, he actually stopped because he wanted to break up Terry's unit and destroy them piecemeal. Thanks to the 54th's, stubborn defence, that everybody got back to his lines where he had a proper defensive position, and Beauregard was like, yeah, I'm not going to try that.
Mm. So, as I say, I mean, it was quite a major thing that the 54th did at the time, that they all almost downplaying the movie. Anyway, so back to the movie. We see the 54th marching into a camp full of relaxing Union soldiers. The reporter that we saw earlier tells Shaw that General Lee, the Supreme Confederate General, has been beaten at a battle. Shaw finds Private Tripp sitting by a river. Shaw tells Tripp that he fought very well in the battle, and Shaw says that Tripp should bear the regimental colours, hold the flag. Tripp seems reluctant, and Shaw tells him to, speak what's on your mind.
Wanted to say something, sir, but I...
Go ahead.
See, I ain't fighting this war for you, sir.
I see.
I mean, what's the point? Ain't nobody gonna win, it's just gonna go on and on.
Can't go on forever.
Yeah, but ain't nobody gonna win, sir.
Somebody's gonna win.
Who? You get to go on back to Boston, big house and all that. What about us? What do we get?
Well, you won't get anything if we lose.
But what do you want to do?
We ain't help and kick in, sir. But I still don't want to carry your flag.
Yeah, I think it's a great scene. And although it's a fictitious character, Private Tripp, it illustrates the conflicting emotions a lot of the black soldiers must have felt. And Shaw's answer is just grimly realistic. Mm. It's like, you're definitely not going to get anything if we lose. So let's win and then see where we go.
So back to the movie, we see the Union commander, General Strong, briefing a group of commanders. He tells them that to take Charleston, a major Confederate city, they first have to take the forts defending her harbour. The first fort is Fort Wagner. The general lists the fort's artillery and tells them that they'll be assaulting the fort at dusk the next day. The approaches to the fort are narrow, and only one regiment at a time can approach. Colonel Shaw immediately volunteers his 54th to lead the attack. That night, the 54th's officers and men spend an evening of contemplation. The men sing and pray around their campfire, while Forbes and Shaw share a silent drink.
Yep, so another quick sweep up on the reality then. And the movie actually misses out a move the regiment made aboard a riverboat. There was only one longboat in which to ferry 20 to 30 men at a time out to it. It was pouring with rain, and Colonel Shaw, the guys knew there was a cabin aboard ready for him, and he stood on the bank launching men out, and he went in the very last boat, soaked to the skin after hours in this rain. It's just another example of things that the men noticed of, he could have gone on the first boat, Colonel leading, meet the captain, oh, where's my cabin? Had a shower, bath,
whatever.
Have some nice food, be in the warm and the dry. No, he's still on the beach, so damn good leader.
Yeah, and you're right, they missed a bit of a scene to portray his affinity with the men by not including that, but maybe they originally did. It's already 2 hours long. Who knows what they had to cut out?
Yeah, and the matter of volunteering is slightly, the emphasis is the other way round. Captain Emilio.
You mean volunteering his troops to be the first people
leading up?
This dangerous thing.
Now, Captain Emilio gives the impression that General Strong and Shaw had already discussed it. And in front of the assembled regimental commanders, Strong says to Shaw, I'd like to offer you the chance to lead the attack. However, I know your men haven't slept for 2 days, they haven't been fed for a day, and, I quite understand if you decline, which of course Shaw didn't. So it's not quite him leaping forward and saying, we will do this. It's more but Emilio in his book says, we think this was not staged, but
yeah,
I think Shaw'd already,
beforehand.
He said it was in keeping with the Colonel's character that he would have already quietly gone to see General Strong and said, please just let us have a position of responsibility.
But the fact that the 54th did put itself forward in some capacity, that is true.
Yep.
And did lead the charge. So back to the movie. We see the men preparing the next day. Shaw inspects the troops. Private Schatz tells Shaw that the men are ready. They march towards the assembly area. Their route has been lined by white Union soldiers. These are the ones that were worried that the blacks won't be able to fight effectively, but none of them are catcalling now. The soldiers who'd argued with Tripp some days earlier call out, "Give 'em hell, 54. Colonel Shaw gives some letters to the reporter, Pierce, "just in case," he says to him. "Just in case if I should fall, remember what you see here." Shaw watches the Union artillery bombard the fort's walls as they prepare to launch the attack. Setting loose his horse, Shaw moves through his men to take his place at the head, to their cheering. He pointing to the colour bearer, Shaw asks who would pick up the colours should the current colour bearer fall. And Thomas Searle, his friend, steps forward and says, "I will." Shaw then orders bayonets fixed and the 54th step off.
Yeah, the fort's defenders see them coming and they mount their thick wall. This is not a stone fort, it's like earthworks.
Yeah.
Pretty formidable. And the Confederate defenders are jeering and taunting. Artillery starts to fall around the regiment as they go to double time, start jogging forward. Shaw calls the charge and they dash forward and men are going down as they run. Shaw and Major Forbes, Sergeant Major Rawlings are urging the men on. They get to the outer defences and approach the wall. Then they get into cover where they're told to keep low until night falls by the CO. So just to wrap that up, Shaw did hand letters to Edward Pierce. Pierce had been General Strong's guest for some days. The scene with the colours was actually General Strong praised the men, telling them as a Massachusetts man himself, he knew they'd do the state proud. And he said, "If the colours fall, who will lift them?" And the answer, quietly spoken from Colonel Shaw, was, "I will." Mm. At which point the men broke out in cheers. So, yeah.
They pushed it all down a rank, didn't they?
Yeah. But Shaw is meant to have made a speech, and it wasn't a hugely rousing one. It was very thoughtful, I think. He just said, "Remember, the eyes of thousands will look upon your night's work, so prove yourselves men."
Which would have gone well in the movie, but not chosen.
I don't know why they didn't do that, no.
Okay, so back to the movie.
Yep.
We see Knight's fallen and the surviving men of the 54th are still 100 yards short of the wall, short of the fort they're trying to take. They're still being fired on by the artillery and also by rifle fire. Again, Shaw calls his men to charge and they dash forward, many more men falling as they go. The Confederate defenders, in good cover, pick men off as they struggle up the slopes. Shaw, still leading from the front, we see the 54th wade through a moat to the final slope before being slaughtered by the Confederates above, all calmly firing down on them. Grabbing the colour bearer, Shaw mounts another charge up the slope, and almost immediately the flagman is shot and Shaw is wounded. He picks himself up and takes a few more steps before finally being shot down.
Yeah, and Sergeant Major Rawlings, Morgan Freeman's character, stares as this is where Private Tripp grabs the colours and starts up the hill. But then shot himself, he collapses as the men rise and charge up behind him. The colours are now carried by another soldier, and Rawlings, Searle and Major Forbes drive the men up into hand-to-hand combat with the Confederates. Thomas Searle is stabbed but saved from the finishing stroke by Private Schatz. More defenders arrive and led by a roaring Forbes, the 54th continue to attack them. Thomas Searle's being supported by Schatz because he's wounded. They get to an internal wall and look down into the fort's inner area where the Confederates have a line of infantry and several guns lined up. And we just see a shocked Forbes and Rawlings stare, and then the screen disappears into a wall of light and smoke as these cannons fire.
The next scene?
Or well, should we...
let's wrap that up.
Wrap that one up.
So we've got the battle of the fort...
Fort Wagner.
And the 54th engaging them. How did they do with that?
Yeah, it seems to be fairly well depicted. The 54th barely returned fire against the defenders, hoping to take the bayonet to them. But they'd been briefed that Fort Wagner had 300 defenders. It turned out there were over 2,000, or nearly 2,000. Colonel Shaw did lead from the start, with many of his officers being wounded. He did charge the rampart. He was shot through the heart and killed quite early in the scene. Now, in reality, the colours were raised and maintained on the ramparts by Sergeant William Carney of H Company. He was later decorated for the action. Captain Emilio, the account The Brave Black Regiment is his book, he was out on the right flank and described the realisation that not only were the fort's defenders capable and brave, they'd also much more numerous. So although several members of the 54th made it inside the outer ramparts, they were just too few number to exploit that and take the fort. So most of the unit's officers and around 50% of the men were either killed or captured or too severely wounded to continue the fight. The defences were just too strong and unable to hold a breach on the wall long enough for reinforcements to arrive and exploit through this narrow defile up which the only approach. The 54th were ordered to fall back. And I mean, those casualty figures are just horrendous. You know, a modern unit wouldn't be considered effective with 50% losses. Really just
horrific stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. The courage shown and witnessed by the rest of the Union Army waiting for their turn to go up if the 54th had been successful.
Just incredible.
You know, really fundamentally changed the attitude towards coloured troops, I think.
Okay, so we've
back to the movie. Film.
The next scene, we see dead soldiers lying along the beach in the approach to the fort. The Confederate flag is still flying over the fort, and we see the Confederate soldiers piling the dead, ready for a mass burial. We see Colonel Shaw's body thrown in with his men, and then the body of Private Tripp lands next to Colonel Shaw's.
And then script tells us that the 54th Massachusetts lost over half their number in the assault. The supporting Union brigades also suffered heavy losses and the fort was never taken. However, as word of the courage and fighting ability of the 54th spread, Congress finally authorized Union-wide enlistment of black troops, over 180,000 of which signed up, and Abraham Lincoln credited these troops with turning the tide of the war and shortening it considerably. And so that's the end of the movie. So we've got a bit of wrapping up to do.
Yeah.
I mean, Captain Emilio, who was the author of one of our source commands, succeeded to command the regiment due to the number of dead and wounded officers. He rallied the men to the colours brought back by Sergeant Carney, the guy we mentioned earlier, who'd stood on the rampart holding the Union flag, even though he had two severe wounds. And there was a lot of confusion. Some white soldiers from other units had got mixed in with the 54th, but they were just organised together into a defensive line in case the Confederates counterattacked, which they didn't.
The more attacks were then launched by the North against Fort Wagner in the aftermath of the mauling received by the 54th, but none succeeded. As the caption stated in the movie, the fort was never taken. However, the effect of the 54th's assault, carried out with unflinching courage and determination, as we've already said, was witnessed by so many white units of the Union, not to mention the Confederates as well, that it was immediate and dramatic effect on the reputation of black soldiers. Suddenly, it was a huge boost to the morale of both the black troops and the Union soldiers, and there was a huge boost to recruitment, as the movie suggests.
Yeah, and the 54th went on to more achievements during the remainder of the Civil War, and they also had the dubious distinction of being the last unit to lose an officer in action just before the ceasefire and the Confederate surrender. Interestingly, some Union officers approached under a flag of truce at Fort Wagner the day after the 54th attacked and asked for Colonel Shaw's body, and the answer they got was, "We buried him with his Negroes." And then after the war's end, Shaw's father was told, because the Confederates eventually abandoned Fort Wagner when they realised they couldn't defend Charleston any longer.
Yeah.
Shaw's father was told his son's body was going to be searched for, it could be returned to burial in his native Boston. And Shaw Sr. protested and refused, saying, "Don't you dare. My son is with his men in death just as he was in life. There is no more fitting burial place for a soldier but the ground on which he died."
There is a dramatic memorial to Colonel Shaw and the Fighting 54th in Massachusetts, which can still be seen. It's this the bronze relief, yeah?
Yeah, and it's stunning.
It appears in the movie, the credits are rolling
yeah.
over this bronze relief, and they don't really explain what it is, but it's this memorial to Shaw and his men in a dramatic action scene.
But I just love his father's take on the... No, leave him where he is. There were 60 of the 54 soldiers captured by the Confederates, at least 20 of whom were wounded, because of the declaration earlier we spoke about, where the Confederates said they'd execute or enslave them, and the Lincoln's administration, the Union government, they retired with, as soon as you do, we'll shoot one of yours. They found it very difficult to find out names and precise numbers because requests for information were refused. However, two of the NCOs from the 54th, Sergeant Walter Jeffries and Corporal Charles Hardy, were tried for their lives, and they were very ably defended by a Southern advocate called Nelson Mitchell of Charleston, who it turns out later seems to have actually had very strong unionist and abolitionist sympathies. And they survived the ordeal, so they were tried. But after the war, only 27 of the original 60 actually survived to be returned home.
Terrible.
But the reputation of black troops after Fort Wagner, as we said, it was no longer based on preconceptions, but actually on the performance, and as it would be for any unit of soldiers. And although it failed, what they achieved was just much more significant than the actual capture of the single fort could possibly have been. You know, as Lincoln said, we've got nearly 200,000 more capable soldiers joining up now. And anyone who was demurring was like, well, shut up.
Yeah, they got equal pay, they got recognition as being good fighting men, and it obviously was a great morale booster to the whites and blacks of the North. The effectiveness of the 54th.
I think, unfortunately, though, after the Civil War, because in terms of real politics, you can understand Lincoln's take on the fact that, the administration's take on the fact that if we really hammer the South now, it's just going to rebel again and again. So we went into this Reconstruction,
right,
which tried to said no, you can't have slavery, but they tried to keep their Southern way of life. The result of which was another 100 years till the events at Selma and the Civil Rights Movement for them to actually get to. And you just think, Private Tripp was right.
Yeah,
you know, we're going to fight for you. We're going to win.
And nothing really is going to change.
You're going to abolish slavery, great. And then what's actually going to change for me and my people? And you know, and we still have it going on today with
the, we do with the Black Rights, with the, you know, all the protests in all over America about Black Lives Matter, and
yeah,
it's still not over as
and it's like, you know, how many examples do people need to realise we're people, and some people are horrible and some people are nice and some people are clever and some people are stupid and some people are greedy and some people are generous, but that's not defined by
your colour of your skin
or your religion or your creed or anything. That's character.
Anyway, we digress a little bit. What about the movie then? What's the overall thoughts? I thought it was a good film.
I really enjoyed the film. I really enjoyed it when I saw it when it came out. And when I saw it, I remember thinking, it just never occurred to me that black soldiers fought in the Civil War, because all the depictions I'd ever seen were whites wearing dark blue uniforms fighting whites wearing grey uniforms.
Yeah.
And I knew what it was over slavery, but not. I just didn't think about it. So I think it was really educational.
Yeah, it came along at the right time. It was just before Ken Burns' seminal documentary series.
For the American Civil War, what The World at War was with Laurence Olivier for the Second World War, I think,
for a lot of people. Yeah, and you know, the movie did use Civil War reenactors, but I don't think there were very many back then. It really was Ken Burns' series that reignited interest in the Civil War, and now there's a lot more reenacting enthusiasts. So
yeah,
it was a good film, really good film, won a couple of Oscars, very entertaining. So 8 or 9 or?
Oh, for me, it's a 9 on entertainment.
Yeah, I think maybe an 8 for me.
And I think for history, lots of fictional characters.
That there were really interesting people that they could have used in real history and just completely ignore them and came up with an alternative interesting characters.
But I wonder why couldn't they have told that greater truth using Sergeant William Carney stood on the ramparts holding the flag,
and why couldn't they have made sure a little bit even more sympathetic by portraying him as actually having a wife back in Boston
could be able to mention that
completely just ignored all of that and made it an all male film, really.
I think if we're being consistent, it can't really get more than a 7 on history.
Yeah, I agree.
And then I'm going to knock that up to an 8 because the great... No, it's got to be a 7. It's got to be a 7.
That's pretty accurate.
And 6.5 of that is for the greater truth.
Yeah.
I think.
I like that.
Yeah. So it's a 9-7 from me, it's an 8-7 from you. And next time out, we're going to do Seabiscuit. And we've gone over an hour again. But then we are fortnightly, so...
Yeah. That might be okay.
Yeah, so...
Seems to be working.
So if you listen, if people listen to 30 minutes this Sunday and then save another 30 minutes for next, the Sunday after, and again, what a pointless thing to say at the end of the show.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Sorry, that was my watch just clacking. I'll have to edit that out. So Seabiscuit next, and after that, we're going to go back to Andrew and I's comfort zone,
Sandals.
Swords and Sandals, with the 50s epic film.
50s or 60s?
60s. 60s, I think.
Spartacus.
I am Spartacus. No, I am Spartacus. So is my wife.
Okay, so let's wrap it up then. Thanks for your time, and we'll see you next time with Seabiscuit.
Lovely. Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.